Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. You know, this is our last podcast of 2015. We will return with new episodes in 2016, starting on January 14th with the enigmatic, hilarious, and grumpy Aubrey Plaza. But I encourage you all to take this nice, long holiday break to catch up on any off-camera podcasts you've missed. We've made 50 of these now, so maybe this is a perfect time to pour yourself a stiff eggnog drink, sit down by the tree or the menorah, and dive right into some of the off-camera podcasts in our archive. We've done a lot of work this year, learned a lot, and yet I feel like we are just getting started on this adventure. Off-camera has been the most unexpected journey for me, and it has been so exciting to watch it grow and gain momentum. The most exciting part has been seeing how the show is connecting with people out there, through this podcast and through our television show, website, and magazine. Way back in Off Camera number one, I wrote sort of a mission statement that included these sentences. I have a strong negative reaction to overproduced, overhyped, overstimulated pieces of short content that leave me feeling like I am learning nothing. It has taken me a lifetime to develop my attention span, and I want to use it. I like a long book, a long documentary, and I like a 15,000-word magazine profile. I created Off Camera for those of us that salivate at the prospect of a good book, a stiff drink, and an afternoon with no plans. I know, as lofty and self-aggrandizing as those words sound to me now, the essential message remains true. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that the most satisfying thing about starting Off Camera is that I have found this community of like-minded people that seem to feel the same way as me. And every time I get an email from one of you, I feel a little spark of encouragement to keep this thing going and to try to improve upon it. So I want to thank you, the listeners, for your support of the show. You're the whole reason we are doing this thing. And a holiday message wouldn't be complete without a little shameless plea for help. So I ask you this favor. If you're enjoying the show, if it causes a little bit of joy to come to your life, if you learn something from it about your own creativity, or if you just like the soothing tone of my voice, then please, spread the word. We are not a big show. We do not have a marketing or advertising department or budget. People find out about Off Camera by word of mouth. So if you like us, share what we are doing in any way you can. Thank you, and have a lovely holiday. And now, let's get to it, shall we? My guest this week is actress, screw-loose optimist, freak, and geek, Linda Cardellini. If you heard my conversation with Judd Apatow several episodes back, you'll know I'm a big fan of Freaks and Geeks. So getting to sit down with its star, Linda Cardellini, was kind of like an early Christmas gift. She told me it was a role she didn't think she'd get, and one she was actually advised not to take. She's pretty much ignored naysayers throughout her career, calling herself a screw-loose optimist. The result is a diverse body of work, connected mainly by the authenticity she brings to every one of her characters. If you want a great example, look no further than her under-the-radar film Return. You'll be glad you did. Linda and I talk about how she got into acting, her fateful Freaks and Geeks audition, and the importance of overcoming self-criticism. We also geek out just a little over Larry McMurtry. As we spoke, it became increasingly obvious how much she loves doing what she does. A good thing, because I think she's going to be acting for a long time to come. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Sam.
Thank you for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
I've watched you for a long time and discovered you probably like a lot of people through Freaks and Geeks originally. But I've really enjoyed watching your, I don't know, in a weird way, you get to see someone grow up when they start really young. And I've really enjoyed watching your career path. And
so Thank you.
It's fun to have you sitting here.
Thank you.
And I want to start with a quote.
Okay.
That I found.
That I said?
No, not from you.
Okay, good.
from Jenna Rollins.
Okay.
Who said, the thing about acting is that you don't want to let on how enjoyable it is, or then everybody would want to become an actress. And it made me think about this thing I read about you when you said you had your 21st birthday on the set of your first movie.
Uh-huh. And I think it was a TV show.
Oh, it was a TV show, mm-hmm. Okay. And you said, oh, I had to work on my birthday, but I can't imagine a more enjoyable life than getting to work in this business for every birthday. Like,
yeah.
It was this really optimistic quote. I wonder if that was a thing. Like, I wonder if having your birthday and mentioning it like that if it was a marker for you as, oh yes, I really do love what I do?
Definitely. I think I definitely love what I do, even though you battle with it sometimes, you know? But that period of time, you know, I had worked so hard to try to be an actress at that point. You know, I was only 21, but to me it seemed like every day of my life was like, how was I going to do this thing that I really loved? And, you know, I went from working for minimum wage to being on a television show. And you know, I was on a Saturday morning kids show. I had the greatest time ever. I was at the, it was the summer between my junior and senior year of college. And it was like the most extraordinary gift in the world. And to be able to do that for a living, because I didn't really know anybody who was doing that.
You
or
didn't
how
come
to
from
do
an
that.
Acting family.
No, my brother dabbled in it a little bit. He was a model when I was a kid because he went to a contest. His girlfriend talked him into going to a contest, and he won. And so he did that for a while, and I think I saw him in a couple plays. But nobody in my, it was just, you know, and I'd done some, I started doing plays in school, but it was nobody I knew had actually made a real career out of it. And somehow I had this minor little screw loose that thought, I'm going to be able to do this. And
where do you
I just
think that
didn't
comes
quit.
From?
Well, my dad is really an optimist. He really is. And he's a very creative person. And but you know, lived his life as a businessman and you know, my mom was more of a realist. And I think I had a little bit of both of them, but I think my dad has this sort of entrepreneurial spirit that I think I somehow inherited. It's a little idealistic at times and sometimes not, but I don't know that I ever give my dad enough credit for being the type of person who sort of thought anything was possible. I remember when I was a kid, he told me that we could have a roller coaster in our backyard, and I thought that was totally possible. And I think he thought that was totally possible. It never happened, but it was like that, like big dreams. And I don't know, I just sort of, I was a very emotional kid. And I
you
think,
were.
I think, yeah, and I think, probably more, I let my emotions out more so than most of the people in my family. And I think they were slightly more stoic than I was. And so I didn't know what to do with that. And I found acting, and it was a place to put that that seemed like, I don't know, it somehow seemed to fit there.
Right.
And so, it was on my 21st birthday when I was working, and I had tried so hard, you know, you've tried so hard to get an agent, you try so hard to, you know, you're not union, then you have to become union. You know, I really went through like all of the phases of really trying. I first got to LA, I pulled something down off a telephone pole, you know, call this number, be an extra.
Right, but you just, it's interesting that you did 4 years of college.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of kids who want to be actors, they sort of jump right to that stage and not, maybe they don't do college.
Right.
You know, was that the realist side of you or the idea that, well, maybe I better go to college? I mean, did you have a plan B or were you?
No, I didn't. And my parents were like, please go to school. And I was good at school. You know, that was, I was kind of like, I was able to do school. So I thought, well, I'd gotten offered a small scholarship for theater somewhere else and closer to home. And I decided I was set to go there.
Because you were born up north?
Up in Northern California.
Okay.
Yeah, around the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area. And I was set to stay there. And then at the last minute, I decided that I wanted to be in Los Angeles or New York. And I was really close to my family, so I decided that New York was too far. I was too scared at that point. I had never been to New York at that point either. But I knew I wanted to study theater, so I went to a small school in Los Angeles. And at the last minute, we changed everything, and I went to Loyola. And my whole plan was always never to have to finish school.
Really?
And I didn't. I actually didn't finish my degree. And then after I did Freaks and Geeks and a couple movies, I went back to school and I finished.
You did?
Yeah. And I, at first I thought it was for my parents, you know? And then I realized when I actually finished that last exam that it was sort of for me. It was nice to have my degree after going, you know, I'd gone 4 years but still hadn't finished. It was one of those things where you had two more classes to do.
Right.
So I went back as a returning student. And I remember I was in the cafeteria, and a girl came up to me and she said, "Are you Linda Cardellini?" And I said, "Yeah." She goes, "What are you doing here?" And I said, she liked Freaks and Geeks. And I said, "You know, I'm going to school." I have finished my degree. She goes, well, you're the, you and Busy were the reason that I want, because Busy Phillips also went to Lowell,
right.
were the reasons that I wanted to come to this school.
You blew her mind. She's like, well, wait a minute.
She blew my mind because somebody came up to me in the cafeteria and said something, you know, it would be nice to hear that.
Well, okay, getting back to what you said about being 21.
Yes.
Because you made it sound like you were itching to get, like, started. And I wondered if you had a sense of time even then, like, because I remember being a kid, and I remember I was a freshman in college when I thought, well, maybe I could be a cinematographer. And then I thought, no, I'm too old. I haven't started on that path.
Like, right.
I had this really skewed sense of time.
Yeah. Oh, I also had that.
Did you think like, oh, everyone else has so many more years of experience
Absolutely.
On me?
Absolutely.
You did?
Yes.
And then was that, when you went and did Freaks and Geeks, was that heightened because there was a bunch of young kids? Because you played, which I didn't know this till I started reading about you, you were actually, what, 23 or 24 mm-hmm. on that show, playing a high school kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I played a high school kid for a very long time.
For a long time.
Yeah. Which, growing up, I always looked really young growing up. Which drove me crazy.
But you
I
got
didn't
the
hit puberty till late.
And, yeah,
I didn't
yeah,
like,
yeah.
And it was mortifying. Like, I remember having to shop for my prom dress in the children's section, or like have something. Like, it was actually like I was so underdeveloped that it became an insecurity. And then I got to Los Angeles, and it was something that was good. And then I realized, wow, I've got the rest of my life to get old, so I might as well play. You know, a lot of people I knew wanted to play older, more mature roles who were my age, and I had no problem with it. I thought
right.
that there was, like, especially at that time, there was Freaks and Geeks was such great material. I thought that there was, you know, I had the rest of my life to get old, so I was happy to play young for as long as I could.
Right. Do you think in some ways that shaped you? Or
Yes,
or,
absolutely.
In what way?
I think it made me rely on my personality a lot more. You know, in high school, nobody really paid attention so much to me. And so I think that I grew in other ways. I think it was painful sometimes. You know, by the time I was 16, 17, things changed.
Uh-huh.
But those first few years, and even going up and into high school, I was so, so small that, you know, there was a point where my mom took me to the doctor and they were like, oh, she's never going to be over this height. And I started
oh, really?
Hysterically crying. And I was like, you have to knock it off because the doctor was that height. And then, you know, so it was one
you
of those things.
You had a little doctor?
No, not that little. But, you know, it was like, it was one of those things where it was, you know, when you're a kid and everybody is
yeah.
different than you, it was one of those things. Like, it wasn't the worst thing in the world, but you're a kid and you're you, so you think it is.
Absolutely.
It really wasn't, you know, like, in hindsight, it's what was I thinking? But back then, it you know, it didn't feel very cool to get the children's menu while you're out at high school.
Right. But did you remain, even after you matured and everything, did you remain in your head that same psyche? Did you still see yourself that way, maybe when others didn't, or?
There was a whole time where actually, when I did finally develop, I wanted to wear like the most revealing clothes possible, which drove my brothers crazy. I think it gave me a sense of humor.
Yeah.
You know, I think it really did. Although, you know, everyone in my family has a pretty good sense of humor. But I think it really gave me I think I became a little bit more self-deprecating than other people my
right,
age.
Right, right. So when I think about that age for you and playing a high school kid, there's a certain empathy or a vibe that Freaks and Geeks got totally right about really understanding the humanity and insecurity
yes.
of high school. I wonder if, I don't know if you've ever talked about this with Judd or with Paul, but if they were looking for some quality, even if they couldn't say exactly what it came from, some quality of that empathy or kids that went through that.
I do think they could recognize that.
Yeah.
I think they, you know, not even talking about myself, but I think they were the people that they picked were truthful to different types of people that you recognized in high school, you know, but you didn't necessarily recognize on television at that moment.
Right.
We weren't the usual suspects for TV at that time. You know, there were things on that were sort of like more heightened and
yes.
more romantic than what we had going on. And I think that the bittersweet, painful experience is something that causes humor. And I think that's something that Paul and Judd both went through. And I think everybody sort of went through. And I remember, you know, they used to have all the writers come in with their most terrible experiences, and they put everybody's like real life sort of battles, high school battles, into
oh, really?
The show. Yeah, yeah. I mean, a lot of them were Paul Feig's, but.
Right. Right, well, but starting out in an environment like that must have been very freeing in a way, because there weren't these perfectly segregated lines of this is the kind of show it is.
No, the script was different, I'll tell you that. Like, I remember that at the time, you know, I'd been working for a few years before that, and I had done several good jobs, but nothing anybody else, I don't think, would ever even remember to this day, you know? But I read that, so, you know, I was supposed to test for two other shows, and I was having a good year. That pilot season, I was having kind of a good year, and three shows were interested in having me test for their,
okay.
for their pilot. So I auditioned, you know, if you don't know the process, like, you go and you audition for the casting director, and then the casting director pushes you to the next level, and you go in for the directors or the producers, and then you go into the next level, and you go take a screen test. But in order to do a screen test, you have to sign the contract. So I'd gone through that for the past couple years, and you know, didn't get anything that stuck. And this year I had three things, and they were all for the same network, and NBC. And there were two others that were more strongly favored
right.
than Freaks and Geeks. And I read the script for Freaks and Geeks, and I said, there's nothing like this. I really love it. I mean, it made me cry at the end where Lindsay dances with Eli. Uh-huh. And I mean, just, it was so beautifully written and it was so heartfelt. And if you know Paul Feig, it's just like, it just has his heart all over it,
yeah.
you know? And then with Judd coming in and the people they chose and just bringing that to life was, I mean, it was even lifted beyond the page. So, but I fell so in love with that. And it seemed so human compared to everything else. And I was supposed to go in and test for something else before that, but I knew that if I got the other job, that there would be no way that I could do this job, so I had to pass up.
Do you remember what that was?
It was two things. They never made it.
Isn't that interesting?
I got a phone call from an exec who said, you know, these other two, one of the other two is this, you know, so-and-so, and it's in-house, and it's really probably a stronger choice. And I said, thank you so much, but I've made my mind and I really love this script, which wow. I didn't realize at the time that I was doing something that was powerful, because had I made a different decision, my entire career would be so different.
Well, it's amazing too, at that age, to be able to even feel like you had the option to say
right.
to someone who
I don't know what
clearly
I
knows better.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Now, were your agents, like, was that a conversation? Was it that quick, or do you call your agents and say?
Oh, there were several conversations, but I was set on it. And they were supportive. I mean, they questioned, but they were supportive. And then I got the job, so.
So from the beginning, since you'd worked a little bit, did you feel like that set and that environment was just different from the ground up?
Yes,
it
absolutely,
was.
Absolutely. And I had never worked on anything that I had that much of a vital role in from the beginning, you know? So to be there, I remember one day I walked quietly onto the set after one of my first days there, and I saw this giant high school that they had built inside these sound stages, and it looked and smelled just like a real high school, you know, and it was probably the most extensive set I had seen. And then to realize that I was one of the characters at the center of the show, I started crying. I was scared.
Oh, you were?
I was scared. And I realized that I just felt the gravity, like I just felt the responsibility, and I had never actually felt that before.
Right.
But I remember being overwhelmed by the size of it and feeling a responsibility to something like that. And nervous, hoping that I could do it.
Well, clearly, I think from reading the first couple scripts, I feel like the emotional center is in that house and a
yeah.
lot with you. And so I could see that, you know,
yeah.
I could see that feeling. But, you know, it is funny, that show, and because there's been 1,000 shows before and since, and we've had the ability to see them, and, you know, now with whatever streaming and DVD, whatever, like certain shows stick around. And that one goes less than one full season.
Yeah.
And resonates with people for since.
Like, yes. Yes. It's stunning. It's amazing.
What do you attribute to to that phenomenon happening with that show?
Oh, I think it goes from the top all the way down to the bottom on the show. I think the creators and everyone down the line was doing really special, honest work.
Right.
And I think that they were sort of working outside of the box at the time, which was upsetting to the establishment that we were part of, and that's why it didn't continue. You know, I remember we got an order for 13, so we did 13 episodes, and
right.
then we get a back order for 9 typically, but they renewed us one at a time.
One at a time?
Yeah.
Well, talk about
so
breaking
there had,
somebody's spirit.
So there was this thing of like, you know, and typically on other shows, everybody would be scrambling, but and if they were, we didn't really see it, but the guys were so, and girls, everybody who worked on it, that, you know, especially in the writing room and the producers, they were so intent on keeping it what they wanted it to be, regardless of whether anybody thought it was winning or losing, that is what I think they maintained a certain vision and a certain quality to the show that they wouldn't compromise. And I think that's why it continues to be something that people can still watch.
Yeah, when you say they were really protective of keeping it to their vision, I'm sure the notes were all about marketing it to a bigger audience or trying to...
Yeah, it was having the, I mean, from what I know, it was having having us win some of the time. I mean, we're pretty big losers a lot of the time. And it was pretty painful. And I remember even people watching it at the time saying it was too painful to watch.
So funny. I read a funny story that, whether it's true or not, but you were told by Judd the show was canceled right before you went on David Letterman?
It wasn't Judd, but that's true.
Okay.
It was, I had always dreamed of being on David Letterman. Always.
And yeah, that's got to be a huge thing.
It was just, and I tell this story on David Letterman when I go on David Letterman, and that really happened, which was I was sitting in my living room and I was trying to decide whether to go to Los Angeles or New York for acting, you know?
Right.
And like I said, I was sort of too afraid to go all the way to New York. I was, you know, very connected to my family with a baby. And LA seemed like a year away from them anyways. But I remember I was watching David Letterman, and he would do these segues where he would say, where he'd pick a name, and then he would tell them something right to camera. And he said, "Linda, whatever you do, do not come to New York." And I was sitting there
really?
Watching it. And I can't say that was the ultimate defining thing that made me not choose New York. But it resonated from that
no.
day on. And then when I went on David Letterman, I told that story, and Paul Schaefer remembered, because everybody kind of thought that I was making it up. You know, anybody who I would tell that story to was like, how does that even happen?
Right.
And Paul Schaefer remembered it. So we talked about that on the show. But yes, on the way to David Letterman, which was always a dream, I was in the car, had gotten, I think, off the plane, and I was going to the hotel, whatever it was, but I was in New York only to go on David Letterman because somebody there liked the show and they knew it was in trouble and they wanted to help it.
Oh, really?
And
okay.
When I got into this limo, here I am, I'm in a limo. I'm, you know, the star of this show. I'm going to go on David Letterman of all, you know. I got a phone call from my publicist at the time, and she said, "Honey, I have to tell you something. The show has been canceled." And my heart fell, and I said, it just sank, and I said, "David Letterman's been canceled?" And she said, "No, Freaks and Geeks." And I went, "Oh, do I still get to be on David Letterman?" And she said, "I think you do, yes. I think it's too late for them to cancel." So I went on David Letterman, and he was so
generous.
Did he
know it had been canceled?
Yes. Yes, before, and it became a thing where it was like I was on a show to promote a show that no longer existed. And he was so kind to me, and I later saw him and thanked him for being so kind to me, because it was such a crazy moment in my career and in my life, because here I was on this show where I loved everybody I worked with. I mean, I couldn't have had a greater time. It was the most wonderful community of people. We were so close. We were having the best time doing a job that we thought was so, we all loved our job. You know, we weren't on some show where we were just sort of like punching a time card,
right.
being happy that we were on television. We were just, we really loved what we were doing, believed everything. We rehearsed out of, you know, we rehearsed it all the time. We talked about it. So we lived it. We loved it. And it was gone in an instant. And I remember thinking, sitting there across from David Letterman, like it hadn't really set in because I still had something that I had to do related to the show. And I remember sitting there across from David Letterman And I'm sitting, you know, here's this like dream that you want to achieve. And you think of all these things you want to do when you finally get to be an actor or an actress. And one of them was for me was to be on David Letterman. And I'm sitting there and he's talking to me and he said something about the show being canceled. And at that moment, I looked at his iconic teeth, you know, and smile, and I thought, that is David Letterman telling me that my show is canceled. And that's really actually when it hit me. Because it was just this sort of unbelievable moment. Yeah, and here I am doing this thing you always dreamed of, but this somehow it was actually a very Freaks and Geeks moment.
I would think that there would be this feeling also of, like, did you feel at all like, oh, I'm not even supposed to be here?
I didn't care. I was just so happy to be there, and I was so happy that they let me be on the
really?
Show. Yes.
So you didn't feel like, oh, when people find
where
out.
I feel like I shouldn't be anywhere. I have a certain kind of, you know, I always have to fight that anyway.
You do?
Yes, absolutely. But in that moment, I was just, I mean, well, the great thing about it is what there was nothing to lose. You know,
right.
Like I was there.
Gosh, I mean, that's the very definition of the word bittersweet.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So how do you deal with that as the aftermath? Obviously, the Letterman experience aside, did it feel like you had had enough of that body of work that you were going to be fine? Or did it feel like...
It felt like it was devastating, for sure. I had been working in the industry for a couple years, so I was no stranger to the idea that you might be really attached to something and it just ends. You know what I mean? So,
right.
But this felt... It felt like you were losing your community, too. You know, we were a really strong group.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, those were my best friends. And so at that time, that was really hard, too. You weren't going to show up every day and get to do what you loved with the people that you loved. So that was difficult. But, and then there was a while where they entertained the idea that somebody else might pick it up. Which nowadays somebody would have, but,
right.
But back then that was sort of a long shot, and it proved to be way too big of a long shot. But
and
a lot of people
hard.
Held out hope for a long time that
yeah.
it would. I sort of was more realistic about it.
You were able to step away from it.
I figured it was, well, not that I was able to step away from it, but I was pretty sure that it wasn't going to happen. I'd prepare myself for the idea that
right.
we were done.
Well, you talk about this thing where you have kind of a utopian situation right out of the gate, and then if you get canceled, I would assume, you know, you go to your, at that point you sit down and it's, you think like, you know, am I going to be able to find that again?
Oh,
right?
You like never think you'll be able to find it again. You never think you'll work again. You know what I mean? It's all of those things too. And then, you know, it's like, it's considered, in some ways at the time, is considered failure, you know? And so that's an interesting thing to deal with as well.
Right.
And not only that, not only did they cancel us, but, you know, they put us on at a time where we weren't getting ratings either. So it was no surprise, really, by the time it happened. They sort of were, like, giving us one episode at a time. Like, you know, we all joked that the craft services went from being this lavish spread that we were, you know, all taking food home to just, like, barely a bite.
Right.
And, you know, so it wasn't a total shock, which the guys knew, and that's why they did. I don't know if you've heard the story, but, you know, we shot the last episode, I think two or three episodes before the show actually was canceled, so that we would always have that final episode.
A finish.
So Lindsay would always go and do what you see her do.
Right, right.
And that's exemplary of how they handled the show and how much
right.
they knew what they wanted to do and how they went about doing it.
So do you remember this lull after that, or do you remember kind of
yes,
sitting
I do.
Down and trying to decide? Or were there, because of the work you had done on that show, were there offers... Like, did that change?
There were some, and then there were things that I didn't want to do, and, you know, and it was an interesting time, because even though the show critically was recognized, it really was, and people who had seen it, especially within the industry, really liked it.
Right.
So there was an awareness, I think, about us, but it wasn't the way that the awareness is when you come off something that's incredibly successful. It's very different.
Yeah.
It's very different. We were still sort of, you know, we were all still sort of struggling.
Did you see yourself then as taking a more comedic path or a more dramatic path? Because I think about a lot of those actors on that show, and one of the things that defines you all as a group is that you all seem to be multidimensional in the choices you make and the roles you take. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like that show was an equal parts comedy and drama to me. So did you see yourself like, you know, I want to go in one path or another? Or did you even think
of those terms? I just wanted to do something I liked, whatever that was. I mean, which is still, I still sort of operate the same. It depends on how it speaks to me. You know, I like to choose good stories or, you know, or characters that I haven't had a chance to play. And I think it might be confused people at times.
I wondered about auditioning because the Freaks and Geeks audition is on YouTube.
I know.
I wonder if that bothers you because you know, that's something that's never supposed to be aired, and it really shows how, actually, it's testament to how hard acting is, because that audition is without context, and you have to go in there and decide, you know, in that audition, you play her in a very realistic way that ended up being exactly how you played her on the show, but I could see that decision also being a really scary one, like, I'm going to, because you were so internal, the way a real high school kid was.
Yeah.
You were not showing any emotion, you know? And I watched that and I go, God, that's really brave because, you know, I would think there'd be some inclination in any actor's head that I have to make an impression, right? And yet there's this subtlety to that audition that you have no sets and no wardrobe and everything. You could think that subtlety could get lost if you weren't in the hands of really capable filmmakers watching that audition.
Yeah, you know, when I auditioned for that, originally, the story I knew was they didn't want to see me. And I remember thinking that all I want to do, I most likely will not get this role. All I want to do is do what I feel I see on this page, you know? And so I think, which as a young actor, I feel like, or anytime, you can fall into the trap of wanting to do what you think people want to see.
Right.
And so I was fortunate because of that sort of obstacle. I didn't have that in my head. I wanted to put forth exactly what I felt was there.
So by thinking, oh, I'm not going to get this anyway, you can like experiment
with it. It allowed me to have
it.
A certain kind of freedom. Anyway, of sorts. I don't know why, but it actually made me braver in some ways. And that audition, I remember when I was reading the script and having seen a couple other things that were sort of going at the same time and other things that I was being considered for, the thing that stood out to me with that role was how much she really loved her parents and that she had good parents and how easy it would be to just be a disgruntled sort of bratty teenager.
Right.
But how much more fun and more realistic and more true to my high school years was this thing where you know you love your parents, but at the same time, like, you can't still be the same little kid anymore. And so I was trying to do a lot of that in there in a very like simple way. But when I found out that the audition was available for viewing, my face got hot and I got terrified because I feel like auditioning is so hard as it is.
Yeah.
Just in general as a process is so grueling sometimes that the idea that somebody could see you in that phase of character development is just, it was terrifying to me.
But it also says something about the lexicon of that show and where it is in history that the auditions would be online and watched a lot.
Like, yeah.
It does say something about, you know, the influence that show has that's there. I mean, it's sort of the dichotomy of something becoming successful is those things come out.
Well, and I remember, you know, they had us audition with each other, too.
Okay, because
so
that was
the
just
first time, that was just us.
Okay.
And then they had us come in and audition with each other. And I remember seeing everybody, and mostly everybody, I remember seeing them in the waiting room and watching what those people did and then going in there and working with those people. I mean, it was very... They were bringing things to the table that were very different than what was necessarily on the page, and it was a very creative process from the beginning, which I haven't actually thought about that sitting in that room for a long, long time. But I remember seeing James Franco walk in with like a gas station shirt on, with a name tag on, and that wasn't hip yet. So I was like, what is that guy doing in a? And that's either the coolest thing I've seen or it was cool, but it was not normal. And then I remember seeing Jason playing at Stone, and I remember, like, I just remember seeing all these things that people were bringing to it in a really real way, and they were incredibly unique.
Well, it's so telling that you say that you almost threw it away because you didn't think you were going to get it. Like, I think interesting things happen when we're not so focused on the results.
Yes, absolutely.
And do you think you took something from that in the future? Because I would assume that, I would assume you didn't have to audition as much, but I would think you still had to do a bit of auditioning after.
Oh, I still audition. I still audition. And, you know, sometimes I like to, because then I know we know what we're doing. You know
what
I mean?
You're auditioning them too, right? To see if...
Sometimes, sure. Yeah. So I feel like, you know, it's never... I don't know necessarily that sometimes it's a fun process, but sometimes you can have a really fun audition where you're actually like creating something in there. And some, like, I remember I auditioned for Brokeback Mountain, and I worked with Ang Lee for half an hour in the room, and I never thought I'd get that either.
Right.
And I remember leaving that audition thinking, well, boy, if I don't get that part, at least I just spent 30 minutes being directed by Ang Lee. And then I got the role, and that was even more incredible. But, you know, sometimes an actual audition can be very gratifying if there's something creative that happens while you're there. And other times it can be very stiff and impersonal and terrifying.
But I'm noticing a trend that every time you think you weren't going to get it, you did.
My mother always says if I cry afterwards, then that means I'm going to get it, which I have to stop doing now that I have a child, because she wants to know why I'm crying and I can't say it's over, you know, an audition or a scene at work.
Well, she'll grow up understanding that work means a lot to you.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, there's a fine line. You know, I think there's a fine line of torturing yourself, and you have to be careful not to do it too much, or you'll lose all the joy.
Did you, at a certain point, did you sort of have to make peace with the scrutiny that an actor's under, especially a woman?
I think that here's the part where I think the same screw loose happens. The same screw loose that I have, that I think that I can do what I do, and it led me to do something that I'd never seen anybody else be able to do, and then to be able to actually be doing it and to keep doing it, I think you have to maintain that same loose screw. And I think that it creates creates a barrier where certain things penetrate you and other things don't, and you learn to sort of, you learn to keep the good and try to shed the bad as much as possible to keep moving forward. Otherwise, you're paralyzed.
Are you self-critical? Like, do you watch performances?
I'm so self-critical that I have to work on it, because it can be debilitating.
Really?
To be honest,
to this day, still?
Yeah, absolutely. About anything and everything. After this, I'll go say, oh, God, what did I say? Huh. Especially when I have to talk to myself.
Well, I'm hoping if you cry, then I know we'll have a good show.
Yeah. I cry very easily, though. That doesn't mean much.
When I was little, I guess third, fourth grade, a friend of mine, Steve Elliott, got a tape recorder for Christmas. And we made a fake radio show.
Right.
And I was horrified when I heard my voice.
Yes.
And I wonder if that happens on just this crazy level when you see yourself on television for the first time.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I mean, do you remember sort of having to go through developing a process for being able to remove yourself from that?
I think I'm still developing that process. But, you know, yes, absolutely. I remember somebody, saying that Lindsay Weir, not even Linda Cardellini, but Lindsay Weir had some bad hair, which is kind of similar to I have my
you have very good
do
hair.
Has not changed too much. Thank you. I owe that to David out there. He's great. But I remember them saying Lindsay Weir had bad hair, and it hurt my feelings, like terribly hurt my feelings. And I thought, oh my God, if I can't take that kind of criticism, I'm in big, big trouble. So you just sort of stop reading things, and when you do read them, you justify things, and you let it hurt, and you.
But do you learn from it too? Like, can you watch something you've done and learn something from?
That's hard, because if you watch something you've done, yes, I think, and no. I mean, it's hard to watch something because it's done. It's already finished. You can't, no matter what you learn, you can't take it back into that performance and alter anything. So that's the difficult part about watching yourself, is it's a finished product at that point, you know?
But you can't watch something and say, oh, you know what, I know what I did there, and I learned something from it that I can take to the next time, or is it too specific to each scene?
I think it depends. I think there are some things you can learn and some things you can't. I mean, you know, if you have a, maybe if you have a habit, you could pick up on it. You know, you have to be careful not to just be too superficial about it too. You have to be like, oh my, you know, my elbow in this shot is just, that's my, you know, my least favorite. You know, whatever it is, you have to be careful, because you can get caught up in that if you're not careful, and that has nothing to do with what you're actually really trying to do as an actor.
You know, it's interesting to hear you talk about this stuff, because I feel like in a lot of your performances, you've been very, like, just raw and emotional, and I don't see a vanity play in
thank
your,
you.
You know, I was thinking about Return.
Thank you. Oh, David, thank you. You saw it.
I did.
Thank
and
you.
I really like that film, and I think that, I think your performance was astonishing in that
thank
film.
Thank you.
And you're in virtually every frame of that movie.
Yeah.
And for people who don't know or haven't seen it, it's a film about a reservist who was deployed to Afghanistan or Iraq or...
It's never completely clear.
Okay.
That she made it, but yeah.
And you come back to your same small town and you just, everything's different. And I think the film may, you know, whether that was your choice or the director's choice or both, there's this idea of letting the audience supply all of the information about what she's going through in terms of what we know about what must happen to you when you come back from
yes.
a situation like that. So there's no visits to a therapist or to...
No.
There's no medication. There's no any of that. There's this person struggling and just not connecting with somebody. And there's no vanity there at all in that film. And it's a very, it's a slice of realism that I think is, I mean, I know the film went under the radar, but you know, I wondered if that was the kind of role where you feel like, you know, you get to go so deep into a backstory and into research and then take all that and internalize it.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like that film, you couldn't have done that role unless you really understood who that person was, I guess.
Thank you for seeing that movie. That's one of my favorite things that I've done. And Liza Johnson, who directed it, that was very much her. You know, her and I had a really close relationship. The movie took a long time to actually be made, and I was connected to it for a long time. And her and I spent a lot of time together talking about it, researching, going to different places, and doing different things, so that I knew there would be a lot of quiet moments, and to be able to fill that with as much as possible. You know, the scrutiny does. While you're working is deadly, so that you have to try by all means not to do. But the self-scrutiny after the fact is more more of what I'm
right.
talking about.
Right.
But I mean, not even just watching it, but just like going home that night thinking of like sort of the Monday morning quarterbacking of like there's infinite possibilities of how to play a scene, and did I find them all, and did I, you know, was I able to do it in the most honest way, and you know, and so
yeah.
so that kind of scrutiny is sort of what I'm talking about, like how can I actually be better every day, better and better every day.
Right.
And you can't be a perfectionist about it, and that's really difficult sometimes to let go of, is there is
right.
no one right answer. But that film was so fast, and we shot so many hours in a day, and it's relatively, you know, a small amount of days to do so. There's something great about that, because there's no time for you to beat yourself up. There's only time for you to do your work and to go to sleep and to get up and do your work again the next day.
You know, that's interesting, like the idea of, I mean, it's that blank page thing, right? Like, if someone said, okay, we have as many days as we want to make our movie,
yeah.
and we have an unlimited budget, I think everyone would be frozen. But it must be kind of heartbreaking to do amazing work and then just see, like, you know, you see zillions of dollars in marketing thrown at certain films, and
yeah.
you see how that can happen, and then you see these films that I mean, to me, I love stumbling across something like that.
Yeah.
I think that's half the reason I
love
doing this.
I hope more people stumble across it.
Exactly, but you know, is that? I guess that's just sort of out of your hands, and you can't.
That is out of your hands, and I did everything I could to try to get the word out there.
Right.
For people to be able to see the film, because we were so proud of it, and I did things that I probably wouldn't normally do, you know, and so. that was a great experience as well, is to feel that passionate about something that, you know, you just do things to help it get out there so that people, there's a visibility of it, you know, for it, which, you know, is, you learned it's hard to do with just one person, you know,
right,
not one,
right.
I wasn't the only person. I mean, no, everybody who was involved with the film wanted to do it, but it was one of those things where I really tried to like pound the ground and do as much as I could so that there would be an awareness about the film.
Yeah. Well, when you think of all the films every year that come out that are worth seeing and slip under the radar, and then you find something, you know, years later. I mean, it's not that dissimilar from finding Freaks and Geeks as in, you know, 10 years after it's done or something. And that's the beautiful thing about film, and even now, even more so, that it just because it didn't initially maybe catch on in theaters or whatever, now there's this giant life that a film can have.
Yeah,
and people
yeah.
can go, you know, I love the discovery of all that happens. But I was curious about the timing of that film and whether you had your daughter yet when you made that.
No.
That must have been almost the last project you did before she was born.
Yes.
Okay, because I read that you sort of took a little break.
I did.
Okay, so that's interesting.
So I took that was one of the only things I did during that time. Except for when I found out I was pregnant, then I did an episode of a TV show because I was like, I'm not going to be able to work for forever, and I just want to do something before I go into this sort of like, you know, long break. But before that, I had taken a break. After I finished ER, I was on ER for 6 years.
Yeah.
And at that point, I wanted to try to reassess, you know, 6 years of doing, there were 24 episodes a year. It was a lot of shows and a lot in the same, you know, it was the same character for quite a bit of time, although I got to do Brokeback Mountain during that time, mm-hmm. and I got to do, you know, a lot of other things as well. But I just needed sort of, I hadn't really rested much. And I think if you don't, for me, at that point, I had been working, like you said, sort of consistently for so long, I needed a little bit of a break to let my real life catch up for a second. And so I sort of changed everything.
How so?
I changed all my representation. I changed my psyche about things, and I just sort of was like, I'm going to travel, and I remember going in and meeting for a show that was a fantastic idea, and everyone's like, you should really do this, and I said, you know, I love what you're saying, but I haven't had a real break, and I really, not that I need a break, but I really want to find out who I am again and what I have to offer in terms of acting. I want to reassess it, you know, and as an artist, if you will.
Yeah.
And
I will.
And good, thanks. And so I took a break, and I said, unless something comes along that I just cannot say no to, I'm going to just sort of chill out for a minute. I wasn't going to do another series. I wasn't going to do anything else. And so I traveled. I went all over, and I went to Italy, and, you know, I did some traveling, which I was fortunate enough to do after earning money on the show.
Sure.
And I had been working at sort of like a breakneck speed for so long before that. Yeah.
But it's interesting because you came back, and I read this thing where you said, I came back, you know, I did Mad Men, and I got to play a woman, mm-hmm. and I've been playing girls for so long.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't know. I thought about the idea of taking this break and then coming back and sort of playing a character you've never played before on a different level. I mean, did you think about that stuff specifically, or did you think about how I want to go forward post-child? Because, you know, also being a mom.
No, I didn't. I mean, maybe not consciously. I don't think that was... I think it usually boils down to... either what you can create for yourself or what is available to you. And I think that at the time, you know, and usually I just look for whatever is coming my way that moves me in some way, shape, or form. I was a giant fan of Mad Men. So that coming along was an interesting thing, and I wasn't sure because I just had a baby, like, how am I gonna do this? And I had to audition, you know, everybody has to audition. And I didn't know anything about the part, and I was scared. You know, I didn't know if I would come in and it would be like, oh, here are the papers, and I'm out, you know? Or if it was gonna be something where, it was this longer sort of involved thing. And my manager, who manages a couple, you know, he knew people on the show, was like, you know, they're so great. They say it's gonna be something great. And I think, you know, you have to believe them. And when I met with Matt Weiner, he said, don't worry, it's going to be something great. And knowing the show already, yeah. It was easy to trust that. And the idea of living in that era did appeal to me because it was a different way for people to see me.
Yeah.
You know, I'm always, whether it's right or not, complimented when people can stand next to me and not know that it's me in something. You know, that to me is, I don't want you to think, oh, there's her doing that in that wig. You know, I want you to believe it first and then be like, oh, that's who that is, you know?
Well,
so
yeah.
For me, that part of it was exciting. And just sort of the way that character unfolded was very much a gift at that very moment in time for me.
Well, now you're on Bloodline.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing cast. Sam Shepard plays your father and Sissy Spacek plays your mother. Kyle Chandler is your older brother. Ben Mendelsohn is there. And it's this amazing cast and you're this family. But I wonder if you come on a set like that and see this actress who's been doing it for so long. I mean, did you get close to her in a way of sort of almost like, you know, here's someone with a career that anyone, a longevity in this business that anyone would want?
There's no way to be that nervous around Sissy because she's such an incredibly grounded, beautiful, sweet, generous person. She's just so talented. And then watching her work and watching, the great thing about being on that set is there are so many incredible actors, which I've been really lucky to work with a lot of incredible actors. But watching, because you work so closely with people in scenes, you know, and I'll have scenes with Ben, then I'll have scenes with Kyle, and then I'll have scenes with Sissy, and then I'll have scenes with Sam. And to watch all these greats and how differently everybody works, you know, because all along as you're growing, you're like, there must be one way to do this, and there must be one right way to do this, and you keep learning time and time again that it's not. It's incredibly personal.
Yeah, what's the lesson there when you see that everyone gets there their own way?
Not to worry about it. Just you got to do your own thing, your own way. And that's, you know, it's funny because I think when you, like, everyone's like, what do you know, if I see young actors, like, what is your advice? And my advice is always sort of like this, which is when you come to LA and that's what you know, or wherever it is, and you want to be an actor, you think of how to do it. And you think of, like, how can I make myself this in order to get that?
Right.
And I think that is the most damaging thing. I think the only thing that you have to offer is who you are. And it's very easy, especially as a young actor, to get that taken away from you or molded into something else. And the only real thing you have to offer is yourself, you know, and where you come from and your perspective. So watching everybody work, it just reaffirms that, you know, sort of.
Well, it also brings up the question of what kind of life do you have to lead to really be able to be an actor? Like, there must be some desire as an actor to make sure to live as full of an artistic life as possible so that you're not too interior just based on the work.
I think it changes. I use different things at different times.
Yeah.
And, you know, because I think at some point you can hit a wall with a certain way of doing things. You know, it's like if you exercise the same muscle in the gym all the time, you kind of got to switch it up in order to get the, you know, full body, and you have to sort of shock your system. So sometimes you have to do things like that, you know.
Is that where it helps watching another actor, that sometimes something that they don't even know they're doing is like a key and it goes, oh.
Yeah, or I think, you know, sometimes what helps is that somebody thinks something's not working and you can see that it is. You, not even if you're in the scene with them, because you don't want to be watching in the scene, but, you know, like sometimes you think people come off and they're like, ah, that didn't seem 100% right. But when you're watching it, you see something that they can't see in because they're themselves, you know?
Well, it must be reassuring to see that all these methods get people to the same place, which is that they're believable and they're...
Yeah, and you can work completely differently than the person next to you, and it can still work in a scene.
Right,
you know?
Right. Well, I mean, going back to Sissy Spacek, it must be inspiring to look at a woman who's, you know, had that kind of longevity and had that kind of variety to her career, right? I mean, do you think about the long term and wanting to do this for a long time?
Oh, yeah.
And let your daughter grow up seeing you do this? And it's so against the odds, you know.
Yeah.
It's so to your screw loose philosophy.
Yeah.
Of like, how, like, not only to be a working actor and make money at it, but to keep going, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's crazy, you know. And maybe it all goes back to your dad being a guy who is an optimist, right? Because you didn't have the dad that said, oh, you know, that's a one in a million thing.
They probably felt like that. They did. I mean, but, I heard that a couple times.
Right.
But, you know, but...
They didn't discourage you.
No, they just didn't want to see me get my heart broken. Right. Which they had to, you know, call them up upset. I didn't get a part or, I, you know, whatever it is, you know, and it's still happening. But I understand them now better than I could have ever before.
Yeah.
You know, I watch some of those shows and I watch the parents now. And when I'm watching, like, The Voice, I watch the parents backstage wringing their hands and crying for their kids. And I think, oh, my God, if that were my kid, I'd be having a heart attack. And I think that's maybe a little bit of what my parents felt me going into this field and even still. So it's,
yeah,
you know, well, it's you don't want to watch anybody criticize or hurt your kid.
And you always seem to, in interviews I've seen, say how close you are to your parents. And,
yeah.
And I can imagine that, you know, I mean, obviously as parents, we have to let our kids get their hearts broken or they'll never take a risk.
Yeah.
But it must be incredibly hard to watch, especially when your kid picks something that's so one in a million.
Yeah, my dad's first question is always like, you don't have to be naked, do you? he always gives me a lecture about how it was better in the old days when they just did a fade out.
Right.
And that I should tell the director that. I said, okay, Dad, I'll tell him.
Was Mad Men the hardest thing for him to watch?
My mother said, are you ever going to get out of bed with that man? And I said, probably not. If the script, you know, if it stays good, probably not.
So, I mean, you're busy. You're living in Florida and you're doing Bloodline, which,
yes,
by the way, it's kind of an incredible age of television that you could do a whole season before it comes out, and then all of a sudden it's just there. And you've done a couple films recently too. You did Daddy's Home with Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg,
yeah,
and then a Michael Keaton film that
it's called The Founder.
Called The Founder. Okay, so obviously you watched the trailer of Daddy's Home, and I, you know, there are a few comedies, and I have an old friend, a guy I grew up with, and we pick like one comedy a year that we have to see together because it's just our kind of thing. And Daddy's Home seems
That's
like
very
that
cute.
In terms of having a heart and being sweet and also being kind of raunchy and weird. And
I saw it. I think before I left for Florida this last time, and I got to see it in a little screening, and I thought it was, it's just so fun. It's so fun to watch. I came in and I felt better when I left than I did when I walked in. And I couldn't even sort of criticize myself in the movie because I enjoyed the movie overall so much. And I think that, I just think it's a really sweet, really funny, sort of a not unusual, but unusual movie, if that makes any sense at all. It's just different than the most of the comedies you see. It's got a sort of a hopeful, sweet message to it, and it's really incredibly funny. And I think Will and Mark are doing exactly what you want them to be doing in
right.
the best way possible.
It must be a good test of you know, knowing that you like your performance and you're like, if you can get, is that the test, if you can get lost in the movie itself and not sort of scrutinize yourself, that everything's sort of just working?
I think that's a good test.
Yeah.
I think for me, it was so much fun to watch, and it was so much fun. I just thought it was so sweet and funny and cute, and it's going to be perfect timing, I think, for families.
And it's probably going to be huge.
I hope so. I think they did such a great job with it. I'm really excited about it.
Well, you're so fun to talk to. And we didn't even get to Larry McMurtry.
Oh, I love Larry
and
McMurtry.
And Lonesome Dove and Comanche
Lonesome
Moon.
Lonesome Dove but when I was working in Brokeback Mountain, okay, I'm going to get to it real quick.
Okay.
When I was working in Brokeback Mountain, Diana, his writing partner and producing partner, said, you know, I said, I haven't really read that many of Larry's book. She said, okay, if you're going to read one, read this one. And it was Lonesome Dove, and it was, you know, like almost 800 pages or something like that. And I was like, oh, that one. I like to read, but I didn't know that I would have time for all of that one. And I read it in an instant. It became one of my favorite books of all time. And it's just beautiful. And then I went and read all the prequels and all the sequels and became just like an enormous, enormous fan.
And then you get to be in Comanche Moon.
And as a result, they asked me to be in Comanche Moon. So
his work and you know, Last Picture Show and everything that Larry McMurtry's done is so, I don't know. There's a romance to reading those books.
There is, and it was really a joy to have met him and worked on his stuff. And it's just
Well,
pretty
I
amazing.
Wondered when I saw your IMDb profile picture. And
oh my God!
It's you and Comanche Moon
know,
with a prairie
I know.
Dress on.
You know what
I thought. She must really love him.
No, that had nothing to do with me. I had an IMDb Pro account at one point, but then I wasn't using it very often, so I canceled it, and somehow the next day that became my picture. Yes.
They were like, oh, you're going to cancel our account. We're going to put you in a prairie dress for all time.
That's right. So, yeah, it looks like, yeah.
Well, that's a mystery solved.
That is so funny because you're maybe like, that only happened a few weeks ago and you're one of like four or five people who's already said something to me. Yeah, I got to change that.
No, I don't think you should.
I'm gonna have to bribe
I think
them.
That's solidarity with Larry McMurtry. Yeah. I think that's important. And yes, if people are watching this and doing their homework, they should watch Return, and they should read Lonesome Dove, and they should watch Comanche Moon.
Yes. And Return has, you know, it's got Michael Shannon and John Slattery in it.
Amazing.
He's so
Isn't
great.
He? And John Slattery.
Yeah, they're so great.
Although he's creepy in that film.
Which one?
John Slattery.
Oh, yes.
Oh, very
creepy.
Well,
and not Michael, which is great.
And that's right. Well, listen, thank you so much for doing this. I could talk to you all day, And thanks for letting me sort of geek out on Freaks and Geeks.
No, please.
Because I had Judd Apatow on here, and I did it with him, and I came late to it, and it's nice to talk to you, and I don't know, just I just feel like I just love where your career is going.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I feel very lucky, and I'm always sort of feeling like the best is yet to come, so I hope that's true.
I believe that with you.
I sort of always feel like I'm just starting to show what I can do, so I hope that's true.
I think it is. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, folks, that's our last show for 2015. We hope you enjoyed it, and join us next year when we come back on January 14th with the talented, enigmatic, grumpy, and hilarious Aubrey Plaza.
I think when you're on a television show and it's the first thing that people see you do, I don't blame anybody for assuming that that is who I am and that's all I can do. I see it as a challenge because moving forward after the show is over, like my one thing is like I want to do stuff that people would never expect me to do for myself.
How many people do you know who can be completely real while somehow remaining a total enigma? After our next episode, you'll know at least one. Kind of. Aubrey Plaza went from relative improv obscurity to one of the funniest actresses in film and TV virtually overnight, thanks to her deadpan and often disconcerting sense of humor, and the unique take she brings to every role she's offered. We'll discuss the inner workings of comedy, how she landed on Parks and Rec, masturbation, and why she envies Tom Hanks. Not in that order. I had a great time talking with Aubrey, even if she did make me feel a little uncomfortable every now and then. She swears she didn't mean to. You can hear all about it on the next Off Camera, starting January 14th, 2016. And hey, if you're loving the show and you want to even get more involved, like really involved, here's a way to do it. As you may know, we broadcast from lovely Santa Monica, California, and we're looking for creative, hardworking, talented young people to come help us out. We have positions open for interns, assistant editors, and other creative folks. So if you're interested in joining the off-camera team, send a cover letter telling us why you want to come work for us, along with your resume, to info@offcamera.com. Maybe you can join the team. So have a great holiday, and we'll see you next year off-camera.